The Man in the Brown Suit, Agatha Christie. Chapter 32. Anne's Narrative Resumed. I had great trouble with Suzanne. She argued, she pleaded, she even wept before she'd let me carry out my plan. But in the end, I got my own way. She promised to carry out my instructions to the letter and came down to the station to bid me a tearful farewell. I arrived at my destination the following morning, early. I was met by a short, black-bearded Dutchman, whom I'd never seen before. He had a car waiting, and we drove off. There was a queer booming in the distance, and I asked him what it was. "Guns," he answered laconically. "So there was fighting going on in Joburg." I gathered that our objective was a spot somewhere in the suburbs of the city. We turned and twisted and made several detours to get there, and every minute the guns were nearer. It was an exciting time. At last, we stopped before a somewhat ramshackle building. The door was opened by a Kaffir boy. My guide signed me to enter. I stood irresolute in the dingy square hall. The man passed me and threw open a door. "The young lady to see Mr. Harry Raeburn," he said, and laughed. Thus announced, I passed in. The room was sparsely furnished and smelt of cheap tobacco smoke. Behind a desk, a man sat writing. He looked up and raised his eyebrows. "Dear me," he said, "if it isn't Miss Bedingfeld." "I must be seeing double," I apologized. "Is it Mr. Chichester or is it Miss Pettigrew? There's an extraordinary resemblance to both of them." "Both characters are in abeyance for the moment. I have doffed my petticoats, and my cloth likewise. Won't you sit down?" I accept a seat composedly. "It would seem," I remarked, "that I've come to the wrong address." "From your point of view, I'm afraid you have. Really, Miss Bedingfeld, to fall into the trap a second time?" "It was not very bright of me," I admitted meekly. Something about my manner seemed to puzzle him. "You hardly seem upset by the occurrence," he remarked dryly. "Would my going into heroics have any effect upon you?" I asked. "It certainly would not. My great Aunt Jane always used to say that a true lady was neither shocked nor surprised at anything that might happen," I murmured dreamily. "I endeavor to live up to her precepts." I read Mr. Chichester Pettigrew's opinion so plainly written on his face that I hastened into speech once more. "You really are positively marvelous at makeup," I said generously. "All the time you were Miss Pettigrew, I never recognized you. Even when you broke your pencil in the shock of seeing me climb upon the train at Cape Town." He tapped upon the desk with the pencil he was holding in his hand at the minute. "All this is very well in its way, but we must get to business. Perhaps, Miss Bedingfeld, you can guess why we required your presence here." "You will excuse me," I said, "but I never do business with anyone but principals." I had read the phrase or something like it in a moneylender's circular, and I was rather pleased with it. It certainly had a devastating effect upon Mr. Chichester Pettigrew. He opened his mouth and then shut it again. I beamed upon him. "My great-uncle George's maxim," I added, as an afterthought. "Great-Aunt Jane's husband, you know. He made knobs for brass beds." I doubt if Chichester Pettigrew had ever been ragged before. He didn't like it at all. "I think you would be wise to alter your tone, young lady." I didn't reply, but yawned, a delicate little yawn that hinted at intense boredom. "What the devil?" he began forcibly. I interrupted him. "I can assure you that it's no good shouting at me. We are only wasting time here. I have no intention of talking with underlings. You'll save a lot of time and annoyance by taking me straight to Sir Eustace Pedler." He looked dumbfounded. "Yes," I said, "Sir Eustace Pedler." "Excuse me?" He bolted from the room like a rabbit. I took advantage of the respite to open my bag and powder my nose thoroughly. Also, I settled my hat at a more becoming angle. Then, I settled myself to wait, with patience, for my enemy's return. He reappeared in a subtly chastened mood. "Will you come this way, Miss Bedingfeld?" I followed him up the stairs. He knocked at the door of a room. A brisk, "Come in," sounded from inside, and he opened the door and motioned to me to pass inside. Sir Eustace Pedler sprang up to greet me, genial and smiling. "Well, well, Miss Anne," he shook me warmly by the hand. "I'm delighted to see you. Come and sit down. Not tired after your journey? That's good." He sat down facing me, still beaming. It left me rather at a loss. His manner was so completely natural. "Quite right to insist on being brought straight to me," he went on. "Minx is a fool. A clever actor, but a fool. That was Minx you saw downstairs." "Oh, really?" I said feebly. "And now," said Sir Eustace cheerfully, "let's get down to facts. How long have you known that I was the colonel?" "Ever since Mr. Paget told me that he'd seen you in Marlow when you were supposed to be in Cannes." Sir Eustace nodded ruefully. "Yes, I told the fool he'd blinking well torn it. He didn't understand, of course. His whole mind was set on whether I'd recognized him. It never occurred to him to wonder what I was doing down there. A piece of sheer bad luck, that was. I arranged it all so carefully, too. Sending him off to Florence, telling the hotel I was going over to Nice for one night or possibly two. Then, by the time the murder was discovered, I was back again in Cannes, with nobody dreaming that I'd ever left the Riviera." He still spoke quite naturally and unaffectedly. I had to pinch myself to understand that this was all real, that the man in front of me was really that deep-dyed criminal, the colonel. I followed things out in my mind. "Then it was you who tried to throw me overboard on the Kilmorden," I said slowly. "It was you that Paget followed up on deck that night." He shrugged his shoulders. "I apologize, my dear child, I really do. I always liked you, but you were so confoundedly interfering. I couldn't have all my plans brought to naught by a chit of a girl." "I think your plan at the Falls was really the cleverest," I said, endeavoring to look at the thing in a detached fashion. "I would have been ready to swear anywhere that you were in the hotel when I went out. Seeing is believing in future." "Yes, Minx had one of his greatest successes as Miss Pettigrew, and he can imitate my voice quite creditably. There is one thing I should like to know." "Yes?" "How did you induce Paget to engage her?" "Oh, that was quite simple. She met Paget in the doorway of the Trade Commissioner's office, or the Chamber of Mines, or wherever it was he went, told him I'd phoned down in a hurry and that she'd been selected by the government department in question. Paget swallowed it like a lamb." "You're very frank," I said, studying him. "There's no earthly reason why I shouldn't be." I didn't quite like the sound of that. I hastened to put my own interpretation on it. "You believe in the success of this revolution? You've burnt your boats. For an otherwise intelligent young woman, that's a singularly unintelligent remark. No, my dear child, I do not believe in this revolution. I give it a couple of days longer, and it will fizzle out ignominiously." "Not one of your successes, in fact," I said nastily. "Like all women, you've no idea of business. The job I took on was to supply certain explosives and arms, heavily paid for, to foment feeling generally, and to incriminate certain people up to the hilt. I've carried out my contract with complete success, and I was careful to be paid in advance. I took special care over the whole thing, as I intended it to be my last contract before retiring from business. As for burning my boats, as you call it, I simply don't know what you mean. I'm not the rebel chief, or anything of that kind. I'm a distinguished English visitor who had the misfortune to go nosing into a certain curio shop and saw a little more than he was meant to. And so the poor fellow was kidnapped. Tomorrow, or the day after, when circumstances permit, I shall be found tied up somewhere in a pitiable state of terror and starvation. Ah, I said slowly, but what about me? That's just it, said Sir Eustace softly. What about you? I've got you here. I don't want to rub it in any way, but I've got you here very neatly. The question is, what am I going to do with you? The simplest way of disposing of you, and I may add the pleasantest to myself, is the way of marriage. Wives can't accuse their husbands, you know, and I'd rather like a pretty young wife to hold my hand and glance at me out of liquid eyes. Don't flash them at me so. You quite frighten me. I see that the plan does not commend itself to you.
It does not.
Sir Eustace sighed. A pity, but I'm no Adelphi villain. The usual trouble, I suppose. You love another, as the books say.
I love another.
I thought as much. First I thought it was that long-legged, pompous-ass race, but I suppose it's the young hero who fished you out of the falls that night. Women have no taste. Neither of those two have half the brains that I have. I'm such an easy person to underestimate. I think he was right about that. Although I knew well enough the kind of man he was and must be, I couldn't bring myself to realize it. He had tried to kill me on more than one occasion. He had actually killed another woman, and he was responsible for endless other deeds of which I knew nothing. And yet, I was quite unable to bring myself into the frame of mind for appreciating his deeds as they deserved. I couldn't think of him as other than our amusing, genial traveling companion. I couldn't even feel frightened of him. And yet I knew he was capable of having me murdered in cold blood if it struck him as necessary. The only parallel I can think of is the case of Stevenson's Long John Silver. He must have been much the same kind of man. Well, well, said this extraordinary person, leaning back in his chair. It's a pity that the idea of being Lady Pedler doesn't appeal to you. The other alternatives are rather crude. I felt a nasty feeling going up and down my spine. Of course, I had known all along that I was taking a big risk, but the prize had seemed worth it. Would things turn out as I had calculated, or would they not? The fact of the matter is, Sir Eustace was continuing, I've a weakness for you. I really don't want to proceed to extremes. Suppose you tell me the whole story, from the very beginning, and let's see what we can make of it. But no romancing, mind. I want the truth. I was not going to make any mistake over that. I had a great deal of respect for Sir Eustace's shrewdness. It was a moment for the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. I told him the whole story, omitting nothing, up to the moment of my rescue by Harry. When I finished, he nodded his head in approval. Wise girl, you've made a clean breast of the thing. And let me tell you, I should soon have caught you out if you hadn't. A lot of people wouldn't believe your story anyway, especially the beginning part, but I do. You're the kind of girl who would start off like that, at a moment's notice, on the slenderest of motives. You've had amazing luck, of course, but sooner or later the amateur runs up against the professional, and then the result is a foregone conclusion. I am the professional. I started on this business when I was quite a youngster. All things considered, it seemed to me a good way of getting rich quickly. I always could think things out and devise ingenious schemes, and I never made the mistake of trying to carry out my schemes myself. Always employ the expert. That's been my motto. The one time I departed from it, I came to grief, but I couldn't trust anyone to do that job for me.
Nadina knew too much. I'm an easygoing man, kind-hearted, and good-tempered so long as I'm not thwarted. Nadina both thwarted me and threatened me, just as I was at the apex of a successful career. Once she was dead and the diamonds were in my possession, I was safe. I've come to the conclusion now that I bungled the job. That idiot Paget with his wife and family, my fault. It tickled my sense of humor to employ the fellow, with his Cinquecento poisoner's face and his mid-Victorian soul. A maxim for you, my dear Anne. Don't let your sense of humor carry you away. For years I've had an instinct that it would be wise to get rid of Paget, but the fellow was so hard-working and conscientious that I honestly couldn't find an excuse for sacking him. So I left things drift. But we're wandering from the point. The question is, what to do with you? Your narrative was admirably clear, but there's one thing that still escapes me. Where are the diamonds now?
Harry Raeburn has them, I said, watching him.
His face didn't change. It retained its expression of sardonic good humor.
I want those diamonds.
I don't see much chance of your getting them, I replied.
Don't you?
Now I do. I don't want to be unpleasant, but I should like you to reflect that a dead girl, or so, found in this quarter of the city will occasion no surprise. There's a man downstairs who does those sorts of jobs very neatly. Now, you're a sensible young woman. What I propose is this. You will sit down and write to Harry Raeburn, telling him to join you here and bring the diamonds with him.
I won't do anything of the kind.
Don't interrupt your elders. I propose to make a bargain with you. The diamonds in exchange for your life. And don't make any mistake about it. Your life is absolutely in my power.
And Harry?
I'm far too tender-hearted to part two young lovers. He shall go free, too. On the understanding, of course, that neither of you will interfere with me in future.
And what guarantee have I that you will keep your side of the bargain?
None whatever, my dear girl. You'll have to trust me and hope for the best. Of course, if you're in an heroic mood and prefer annihilation, that's another matter.
That was what I'd been playing for. I was careful not to jump at the bait.
Gradually, I allowed myself to be bullied and cajoled into yielding. I wrote at Sir Eustace's dictation.
Dear Harry, I think I see a chance of establishing your innocence beyond any possible doubt. Please follow my instructions minutely. Go to Aggrassato's curio shop. Ask to see something out of the ordinary for a special occasion. The man will then ask you to come into the back room. Go with him. You will find a messenger who will bring you to me. Do exactly as he tells you. Be sure and bring the diamonds with you, not a word to anyone.
Sir Eustace stopped.
I leave the fancy touches to your own imagination, he remarked, but be careful to make no mistakes.
Yours forever and ever, Anne, will be sufficient, I remarked.
I wrote in the words. Sir Eustace stretched out his hand for the letter and read it through.
That seems right. Now the address.
I gave it him. It was that of a small shop which received letters and telegrams for a consideration. He struck the bell upon the table with his hand.
Chichester Pettigrew, alias Minx, answered the summons.
This letter is to go immediately, the usual route.
Very well, Colonel.
He looked at the name on the envelope.
Sir Eustace was watching him keenly.
A friend of yours, I think.
Of mine?
The man seemed startled.
You had a prolonged conversation with him in Johannesburg yesterday.
A man came up and questioned me about your movements and those of Colonel Race. I gave him misleading information.
Excellent, my dear fellow, excellent. Said Sir Eustace genially.
My mistake.
I chanced to look at Chichester Pettigrew as he left the room. He was white to the lips, as though in deadly terror. No sooner was he outside than Sir Eustace picked up a speaking tube that rested by his elbow and spoke down it.
"That you, Schwart? Watch Minx. He's not to leave the house without orders."
He put the speaking tube down again and frowned, slightly tapping the table with his hand. "May I ask you a few questions, Sir Eustace?" I said after a minute or two of silence.
"Certainly.
What excellent nerves you have, Anne. You're capable of taking an intelligent interest in things when most girls would be sniffling and wringing their hands. Why did you take Harry as your secretary instead of giving him up to the police?"
"I wanted those cursed diamonds. Nadina, the little devil, was playing off your Harry against me. Unless I gave her the price she wanted, she threatened to sell them back to him. That was another mistake I made. I thought she'd have them with her that day. But she was far too clever for that. Carton, her husband, was dead too. I'd no clue whatsoever as to where the diamonds were hidden. Then I managed to get a copy of a wireless message sent to Nadina by someone on board the Kilmorden, either Carton or Rayburn. I didn't know which. It was a duplicate of that piece of paper you picked up.
17-1-22, it ran. I took it to be an appointment with Rayburn. And when he was so desperate to get aboard the Kilmorden, I was convinced that I was right. So I pretended to swallow his statements and let him come. I kept a pretty sharp watch upon him and hoped that I should learn more. Then I found Minx trying to play a lone hand and interfering with me. I soon stopped that. He came to heel all right. It was annoying not getting Cabin 17, and it worried me not being able to place you. Were you the innocent young girl you seemed, or were you not? When Rayburn set out to keep the appointment that night, Minx was told off to intercept him. Minx muffed it, of course. But why did the wireless message say 17 instead of 71? I've thought that out. Carton must have given that wireless operator his own memorandum to copy off on to a form, and he never read the copy through. The operator made the same mistake we all did, and read it as 17-1-22 instead of 1-71-22. The thing I don't know is how Minx got on to Cabin 17. It must have been sheer instinct.
And the dispatch to General Smuts? Who tampered with that?
My dear Anne, you don't suppose I was going to have a lot of my plans given away without making an effort to save them? With an escaped murderer as a secretary, I had no hesitation whatever in substituting blanks. Nobody would think of suspecting poor old Peddler.
What about Colonel Race?
Yes, that was a nasty jar. When Paget told me he was a Secret Service fellow, I had an unpleasant feeling down the spine. I remembered that he'd been nosing around Nadina in Paris during the war, and I had a horrible suspicion that he was out after me. I don't like the way he's stuck to me ever since. He's one of those strong, silent men who have always got something up their sleeve.
A whistle sounded. Sir Eustace picked up the tube, listened for a minute or two, and then answered.
"Very well. I'll see him now."
"Business," he remarked.
"Miss Anne, let me show you your room."
He ushered me into a small, shabby apartment. A Kaffir boy brought up my small suitcase, and Sir Eustace, urging me to ask for anything I wanted, withdrew. The picture of a courteous host. A can of hot water was on the washstand, and I proceeded to unpack a few necessities. Something hard and unfamiliar in my sponge bag puzzled me greatly. I untied the string and looked inside. To my utter amazement, I drew out a small pearl-handled revolver. It hadn't been there when I started from Kimberley. I examined the thing gingerly. It appeared to be loaded. I handled it with a comfortable feeling. It was a useful thing to have in a house such as this,
but modern clothes are quite unsuited to the carrying of firearms. In the end, I pushed it gingerly into the top of my stocking. It made a terrible bulge, and I expected every minute that it would go off and shoot me in the leg, but it really seemed the only place. Chapter 33. I was not summoned to Sir Eustace's presence until late in the afternoon. 11 o'clock tea and a substantial lunch had been served to me in my own apartment, and I felt fortified for further conflict. Sir Eustace was alone. He was walking up and down the room, and there was a gleam in his eye and a restlessness in his manner which did not escape me. He was exultant about something. There was a subtle change in his manner towards me. "I have news for you. Your young man is on his way. He'll be here in a few minutes. Moderate your transports. I have something more to say. You attempted to deceive me this morning. I warned you that you would be wise to stick to the truth, and up to a certain point you obeyed me. Then you ran off the rails. You attempted to make me believe that the diamonds were in Harry Raeburn's possession. At the time, I accepted your statement because it facilitated my task, the task of inducing you to decoy Harry Raeburn here. But, my dear Anne, the diamonds have been in my possession ever since I left the Falls, though I only discovered the fact yesterday." "You know?" I gasped. "It may interest you to hear that it was Paget who gave the show away. He insisted on boring me with a long, pointless story about a wager and a tin of films. It didn't take me long to put two and two together. Mrs. Blair's distrust of Colonel Race, her agitation, her entreaty that I would take care of her souvenirs for her. The excellent Paget had already unfastened the cases through an excess of zeal. Before leaving the hotel, I simply transferred all the rolls of film to my own pocket. They are in the corner there. I admit that I haven't had the time to examine them yet, but I notice that one is of a totally different weight to the others, rattles in a peculiar fashion, and has evidently been stuck down with secotine, which will necessitate the use of a tin opener. The case seems clear, does it not? And now, you see, I have you both nicely in the trap. It's a pity that you didn't take kindly to the idea of becoming Lady Pedlar." I didn't answer him. I stood looking at him. There was the sound of feet on the stairs. The door was flung open, and Harry Raeburn was hustled into the room between two men. Sir Eustace flung me a look of triumph. "According to plan," he said softly, "you amateurs will pit yourselves against professionals." "What's the meaning of this?" cried Harry hoarsely. "It means that you've walked into my parlor," said the spider to the fly, remarked Sir Eustace facetiously. "My dear Raeburn, you are extraordinarily unlucky." "You said I could come safely, Anne." "Do not reproach her, my dear fellow. That note was written at my dictation, and the lady could not help herself. She would have been wiser not to write it, but I did not tell her so at the time. You followed her instructions, went to the curio shop, were taken through the secret passage from the back room, and found yourself in the hands of your enemies." Harry looked at me. I understood his glance and edged nearer to Sir Eustace. "Yes," murmured the latter, "decidedly, you are not lucky. This is, let me see, the third encounter." "You're right," said Harry. "This is the third encounter. Twice you have worsted me. Have you never heard that the third time the luck changes?" "This is my round. Cover him, Anne." I was all ready. In a flash I had whipped the pistol out of my stocking and was holding it to his head. The two men guarding Harry sprang forward, but his voice stopped them. "Another step and he dies. If they come any nearer, Anne, pull the trigger. Don't hesitate." "I shan't," I replied cheerfully. "I'm rather afraid of pulling it anyway." I think Sir Eustace shared my fears. He was certainly shaking like jelly. "Stay where you are," he commanded, and the men stopped obediently. "Tell them to leave the room," said Harry. Sir Eustace gave the order. The men filed out, and Harry shot the bolt across the door behind them. "Now we can talk," he observed grimly, and coming across the room, he took the revolver out of my hand. Sir Eustace uttered a sigh of relief and wiped his forehead with a handkerchief. "I'm shockingly out of condition," he observed. "I think I must have a weak heart. I'm glad that revolver is in competent hands. I didn't trust Miss Anne with it. Well, my young friend, as you say, now we can talk. I'm willing to admit that you stole a march upon me. Where the devil that revolver came from, I don't know. I had the girl's luggage searched when she arrived. And where did you produce it from now? You hadn't got it on you a minute ago." "Yes, I had," I replied. "It was in my stocking." "I don't know enough about women. I ought to have studied them more," said Sir Eustace sadly. "I wonder if Paget would have known that." Harry rapped sharply on the table. "Don't play the fool. If it weren't for your gray hairs, I'd throw you out the window." "You damn scoundrel. Gray hairs or no gray hairs, I—" He advanced a step or two, and Sir Eustace skipped nimbly behind the table. "The young are always so violent," he said reproachfully. "Unable to use their brains. They rely solely on their muscles. Let us talk sense. For the moment, you have the upper hand. But that state of affairs cannot continue. The house is full of my men. You're hopelessly outnumbered. Your momentary ascendancy has been gained by an accident."
"Has it?"
Something in Harry's voice, a grim raillery, seemed to attract Sir Eustace's attention. He stared at him.
"Has it?" said Harry again. "Sit down, Sir Eustace, and listen to what I have to say."
Still covering him with the revolver, he went on. "The cards are against you this time. To begin with, listen to that." "That" was a dull banging at the door below. There were shouts, oaths, and then a sound of firing. Sir Eustace paled.
"What's that?"
"Race, and his people. You didn't know, did you, Sir Eustace, that Anne had an arrangement with me, by which we would know whether communications from one to the other were genuine? Telegrams were to be signed Andy. Letters were to have the word and crossed out somewhere in them. Anne knew that your telegram was a fake. She came here of her own free will, walked deliberately into the snare, in the hope that she might catch you in your own trap. Before leaving Kimberley, she wired both to me and to Race. Mrs. Blair has been in communication with us ever since. I received the letter written at your dictation, which was just what I expected. I had already discussed the probabilities of a secret passage leading out of the curio shop with Race, and he had discovered the place where the exit was situated. There was a screaming, tearing sound, and a heavy explosion which shook the room. "They're shelling this part of the town. I must get you out of here, Anne." A bright light flared up. The house opposite was on fire. Sir Eustace had risen and was passing up and down. Harry kept him covered with the revolver. "So you see, Sir Eustace, the game is up. It was you yourself who very kindly provided us with the clue of your whereabouts. Race's men were watching the exit of the secret passage. In spite of the precautions you took, they were successful in following me here." Sir Eustace turned suddenly. "Very clever, very creditable. But I've still a word to say. If I've lost the trick, so have you. You'll never be able to bring the murder of Nadina home to me. I was in Marlowe on that day. That's all you've got against me. No one can prove that I even knew the woman. But you knew her. You had a motive for killing her, and your record's against you. You're a thief, remember? A thief. There's one thing you don't know, perhaps. I've got the diamonds, and here goes." With an incredibly swift movement, he stooped, swung up his arm, and threw. There was a tinkle of breaking glass as the object went through the window and disappeared into the blazing mass opposite. There goes your only hope of establishing your innocence over the Kimberly affair. And now we'll talk. I'll drive a bargain with you. You've got me cornered. Race will find all he needs in this house. There's a chance for me if I can get away. I'm done for if I stay. But so are you, young man. There's a skylight in the next room. A couple of minutes start and I shall be all right. I've got one or two little arrangements already made. You let me out that way and give me a start, and I leave you a signed confession that I killed Nadina. Yes, Harry, I cried. Yes, yes, yes. He turned a stern face on me. No, Anne. 1,000 times no. You don't know what you're saying. I do. It solves everything. I'd never be able to look Race in the face again. I'll take my chance, but I'm damned if I'll let this slippery old fox get away. It's no good, Anne. I won't do it. Sir Eustace chuckled. He accepted defeat without the least emotion. Well, well, he remarked. You seem to have met your master, Anne. But I can assure you both that moral rectitude does not always pay. There was a crash of rending wood, and footsteps surged up the stairs. Harry drew back the bolt. Colonel Race was the first to enter the room, his face lit at the sight of us. You're safe, Anne. I was afraid, he turned to Sir Eustace. I've been after you for a long time, peddler, and at last I've got you. Everybody seems to have gone completely mad, declared Sir Eustace airily. These young people have been threatening me with revolvers and accusing me of the most shocking things. I don't know what it's all about. Don't you? It means that I've found the colonel. It means that on January 8th last, you were not at Cannes, but at Marlowe. It means that when your tool, Madame Nadina, turned against you, you planned to do away with her. And at last, we shall be able to bring the crime home to you. Indeed. And from whom did you get all this interesting information? From the man who's even now being looked for by the police? His evidence will be very valuable. We have other evidence. There's someone else who knew that Nadina was going to meet you at the mill house. Sir Eustace looked surprised. Colonel Race made a gesture with his hand. Arthur Minks, alias the Reverend Edward Chichester, alias Miss Pettigrew, stepped forward. He was pale and nervous, but he spoke clearly enough. I saw Nadina in Paris the night before she went over to England. I was posing at the time as a Russian count. She told me of her purpose. I warned her, knowing what kind of man she had to deal with, but she didn't take my advice. There was a wireless message on the table. I read it. Afterwards, I thought I would have a try for the diamonds myself. In Johannesburg, Mr. Rayburn accosted me. He persuaded me to come over to his side. Sir Eustace looked at him. He said nothing, but Minks seemed visibly to wilt. Rats, always leaving a sinking ship, observed Sir Eustace. I don't care for rats. Sooner or later, I destroy vermin. There's just one thing I'd like to tell you, Sir Eustace, I remarked. That tin you threw out of the window didn't contain the diamonds. It had common pebbles in it. The diamonds are in a perfectly safe place. As a matter of fact, they're in the big giraffe stomach. Suzanne hollowed it out, put the diamonds in with cotton wool so that they wouldn't rattle, and plugged it up again. Sir Eustace looked at me for some time. His reply was characteristic. I always did hate that blinking giraffe. It must have been instinct.